Here are some American voices speaking about freedom of religion.
Well, currently there's a lot of tension in America over religion. It's similar to when the Irish came here and they had tension with the Protestants, and now it's the Muslims having tension with the Christians. But I think these things will be overcome over time.
It's important for people to be able to have religious freedom because everybody has a different higher being. And I know who I believe in, and I think everybody should be able to believe in who they want to believe in.
Free thinking is important to me, and that the ability to worship or think in the ways that are best suited for your life and experience are important to me. The U.S. believes that it is special in its religious freedoms. Whether it actually is exercising a tolerance of diverse religions is something that it continues to try to work on.
You know, people should just be free to just, you know, think, you know, believe what they want.
Because I'm against religion, so I want to be free. In fact, there's a, have you heard of the Freedom From Religion Foundation? Yeah, I'm kind of like with them.
I value religious freedom. As a Buddhist, I believe everyone has the right to believe whatever they want to believe without any kind of reaction from the community or the government.
I don't want people making me practice their particular religion, and I would rather just be able to investigate any religion I'm curious about or have no religion at all if I want.
I don't really pay much attention to it. I just think that you should be able to believe in whatever you believe in.
I think that basically most people in this country don't value religious freedom because they take it for granted. They don't come from countries like in Eastern Europe where you've been forbade to practice religion. So I think looking at it from that perspective, I think it's hard for an American to appreciate religious freedom because we get it so easily.
I think it gives a person a chance to express himself in a free country.
And freedom of your thoughts in spiritual matters, as all other matters, is a foundation for kind of a democratic society. I have to think that there is still some uniqueness to the American experience that clearly historically has valued freedom.
Welcome to Religion and the Constitution. This is a series of conversations about the law and what freedom of religion actually means in the United States. My name is Jerry Dunkley. Religion and the Constitution can get complicated. There is a wide range of issues that relate to our religious freedom. One that has become more relevant in recent years is religious faith in public accommodations. To put it clearly, can a private business, like a restaurant, hotel, or bakery, refuse service to someone because the owner of the business objects on religious grounds to the person who wants service? Or can a government refuse service to a class of people, like a local city? This issue is tied up in the meaning of the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment and the Civil Rights Act. Sections of that act ban discrimination against someone based on race, color, national origin, religion, and sex. Various states have laws also to prevent discrimination in public accommodations, and some states have passed laws that seem to permit some kinds of discrimination, like the law in North Carolina that dealt with transgender bathrooms. We're going to sort out some of this in this podcast. My guest is attorney Sasha Sandberg Champion. He is with Relman, Dane, and Colfax in Washington. He practices in the area of civil rights litigation, particularly religious freedom is one of the issues that he has dealt with. Prior to joining Relman and Dane and Colfax, Mr. Sandberg Champion was a senior attorney in the appellate section of the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. He has also taught at Columbia University School of Law and at American University's Washington College of Law. After that very long introduction, welcome to the program, Mr. Sasha Sandberg Champion. I do appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. Let's get into some of the questions here. We should stipulate at the start that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was aimed in part at things like separate bathrooms for races in the South, hotels and restaurants, refusing service to black people, etc. Is that an accurate foundation for what we're going to discuss?
That is correct. One thing that people may not realize about the 1964 Civil Rights Act with respect to public accommodations is it is actually fairly limited. It's limited to a narrow set of public accommodations like hotels and restaurants, and it is limited to discrimination based on race. It doesn't apply to sex discrimination, for example.
Okay.
And it doesn't apply to religious discrimination.
And one of the aspects of this that for me gets a little complicated is that Title VII of the Act deals with sex discrimination, and Title IX does as well. Is that accurate?
That is correct.
Now, this law applies to governments and to private businesses with more than 15 employees. Is that correct?
Yes.
Does it apply to places of worship like churches or temples or mosques?
No, they are exempted from many of those requirements. And I should add, they're also exempted from the requirements of many other civil rights laws, many of the other civil rights laws, such as the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is where we litigate many of the public accommodations issues these days.
That's interesting that you say that, because I was going to ask about the ADA, just in at least in passing. The ADA is very strong, the Americans with Disabilities Act, is very strong on issues like access to public accommodations for disabled people, but that doesn't seem to have religious implications. Houses of worship are exempt under ADA, is that correct?
Yes, it becomes very complicated, all the reasons why. But it's just been seen as politically expedient to exempt houses of worship from many of the provisions of our civil rights laws.
And that is a First Amendment religious freedom issue, is that correct?
Well, without opining on whether those issues would actually come up in specific cases, it's been seen as best to avoid any chance of them coming up.
Clergy are not required to marry, for instance, gay people if they choose not to, correct?
That is correct.
What are some examples of things that are not public accommodations besides places of worship, as we've discussed?
Well, so let me back up and talk about the concept of public accommodations. The whole point of being a public accommodation is that you're open to all comers. And now I'm talking about something like a supermarket. When you go in and buy a loaf of bread, that institution is not giving an imprimatur on your lifestyle, on your political views, on anything else about you. It does not pass judgment about you. It's not saying anything about you when you buy a loaf of bread. Anyone's entitled to do that. So that's a sort of quintessential public accommodation. Now you look on the other side. You look at something like going to an artist and asking him to create an individualized piece of work. No one would argue that artist is a public accommodation in the same way. It's someone who, as part of their business model, regularly turns away most of the people who would go to that person. So a lot of the fight now is about whether particular institutions are in fact public accommodations in the most complete sense. For example, there is a case that has a petition for certiorari before the Supreme Court involving a wedding cake maker. And there you have an interesting question. That wedding cake maker is defined as a public accommodation under Colorado law, but there's a big question whether that person is really more like an artist and therefore expressing their views about someone when they make the cake, or whether that person is more like the supermarket. So that's really where the fight is at right now. Who is really a public accommodation, and who is really expressing their religious and political views when they do something for you?
This dates from common law, doesn't it? It's not just the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
That is correct. The state law has had this concept of public accommodation for quite some time, starting with, for example, hotels and restaurants, and they always had that concept that you take all comers.
If I read this section of the Civil Rights Act correctly, it does mention places that sell food. So the question for the wedding cake maker would be, is that food or is that artistic expression or both, or how do you sort it out?
Yes, and that is tricky. Well, no one has tried to bring a case against the wedding cake maker under Title II of the Civil Rights Act, as far as I know. The where this comes into play is under state public accommodations laws, which are considerably more expansive, and which often ban discrimination on the basis of, for example, sexual orientation. And that's where sort of the rubber meets the road with these controversies right now.
Many of these issues are fairly current because gay rights have emerged in the United States, particularly since the Supreme Court ruled that marriage between people of the same sex is legal. Is that accurate to say?
That is accurate to say.
Okay. What have the courts said so far in these cases around the country? I know you just said the one out of Colorado is going to be heard by the Supreme Court, but where are we with this?
Well, it may or may not be heard by the Supreme Court. There is a pending, very closely watched petition for certiorari, which means the Supreme Court will decide soon whether or not it will hear the case. What the court decided below, the Colorado State Court decided below, was that it did not violate this cake maker's religious rights and First Amendment rights more generally, which encompass obviously the right to free expression as well as free religious exercise, to be required to bake a cake for all comers.
After this interview was recorded, the Supreme Court decided to hear the Colorado wedding cake case in the fall of 2017. So, if I understand, the Supreme Court has not ruled yet on these kinds of specific cases. Have they narrowed the field as to what is a public accommodation under the law and the Constitution now?
Well, again, the question of who is a public accommodation is typically a question of state law. The question that the Supreme Court has every now and again weighed in on is the question of whether requiring someone to comply with the state public accommodation law violates the First Amendment, in whether with respect to political views or whether with respect to religious views. And I believe the most recent instance of the Supreme Court really stepping into this was a 1995 case regarding the St. Patrick's Day parade in Boston. And in that case, what the Massachusetts courts found was that the state public accommodation law required the private organizers of the parade to include a gay rights organization that was marching with a gay rights message. And what the Supreme Court found was that the First Amendment precluded the state law from requiring that private parade organizer to include a message that it disagreed with.
Even though the parade was on public streets in what would be considered under First Amendment law to be a public forum generally?
Yes. Now, here's the thing. It was not a state-run parade. The parade was actually run by a private entity. Now, if the parade had been run by a public entity, then you would get into the concept that you're just describing, that which is to say it's a public forum and the state has to take all comers to its public forum and can't choose among messages. But to the extent that someone is a privately held public accommodation, they do have the right to control the message that they express.
Let's talk a little bit about the Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, both at the federal and the state level. Let me start with the federal level. Does the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which still applies at the federal level, though it's been declared unconstitutional for states, does it have any impact on these public accommodation cases that we're discussing?
RFRA, as it's known, only really has bite with respect to construction of federal law. What it says is that the federal government itself will not impose a significant burden on religious exercise if there is a non-discriminatory way to accomplish the federal government's goals. So, for example, RFRA was applied to limit in some respects the application of the Affordable Care Act, what people know as Obamacare, with respect to what birth control had to be covered under certain health care plans.
This is the Hobby Lobby case, correct?
That is the Hobby Lobby case. But the important thing is there, it only operated to affect construction of federal law, in that case, the Affordable Care Act. It doesn't have any impact on directly on how a state law should be construed.
We are talking with attorney Sasha Sandberg Champion. He is with Relman, Dane & Colfax in Washington, D.C., and he is a civil rights lawyer, and religious liberty is one of the areas that he works in. Now, let's talk about these various state RFRA laws that have been passed. I know there's a wide variety of them, but what are your concerns or analysis? What is your analysis of some of the laws, like, for instance, the one in Indiana or the one in North Carolina, as to their constitutionality?
Well, I think if you take some of these laws at face value, if you say that all they are doing is guaranteeing everybody the right to free exercise of religion and offering accommodations in instances in which those accommodations can be made and the government can still achieve legitimate objectives, I think they probably pass constitutional muster. The federal RFRA actually went the constitutionality of the federal RFRA went before the Supreme Court, which said it does not violate the Establishment Clause as essentially favoring religion too much, precisely because it always, by its terms, it always still allows accomplishment of whatever the government's legitimate objectives are. The problem with these state RFRAs is it's they are fairly transparently intended to interfere with other people's also legitimate rights. And here I'm now referring to the rights of gay and lesbian people to have equal access to public accommodations, for example. And that's where the tension arises, is really in the application rather than on their face.
One wonders if one of these cases, and there may be one bubbling up through the courts right now, which I'm not aware, but do you perceive that there are going to be constitutional challenges in the federal courts to some of these laws?
I don't think, for the reasons I just described, I don't think that people are going to successfully challenge these laws necessarily on their face, because on their face they are fairly unobjectionable. The problem is that, as applied, you have a real risk that these laws are going to be applied to deny a lot of people equal protection of the laws. To say, in essence, it's okay to discriminate against people in ways that otherwise would not be permissible because my religion requires me to do it. And to the extent that they're applied in that way, I think we will see a lot of we will see challenges to them.
One of the things that's interesting about this whole area is, under the Federal Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause, there is not supposed to be excessive entanglement, quote, close quote, by government in various religious beliefs, any religious belief, favoring or not favoring. And it seems to me that with some of these RFRA laws, there is the potential to move closer to entanglement, that is, favoring one religious belief or several religious beliefs over the beliefs of those who do not have the same feelings, religiously or otherwise, about them.
Well, I think that's absolutely correct in terms of how people are anticipating they will be applied. And again, that doesn't necessarily have to be the case about the laws in the abstract. And let me give you an example. I've actually litigated a case, and there are many such cases, involving the treatment of Native American prisoners and whether, for example, they will be able to grow their hair long in prisons. So that's a sort – and that's under a related law, which is not RFRA, but it's a related federal law.
Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, correct?
That is correct. So, that's a much narrower slice of applications, only applying to institutionalized persons and certain land use decisions. But so it gets litigated on a fairly regular basis to protect the rights of what you might think are minority religions, and that's very different. That has a very different feel for it in terms of the Establishment Clause concerns that you were just describing, as opposed to when it's being used as a hammer to protect the rights of a majority to discriminate against that minority. So that again is where the different applications will determine whether it's constitutional.
One of the things that I've learned as I've tried to study this area more, Sasha, is the whole issue of balancing of rights and how complex this can become.
Yes. So in general, although the doctrine is slightly different in the different applications, in general, there's always a sort of balancing test where you weigh the burden to someone's religious exercise against the how compelling the government's interest is and whether the government can accomplish that interest in another way. And that's always fact-specific, and there's always going to be fights about exactly how that balance comes down.
It is, in effect, an ad hoc balancing case under First Amendment law?
I think that is rather a nice way to call it. In practice, really, courts can reach almost any decision they want, and it's very hard to come up with a doctrinal way to describe all these cases, except that this is how the courts want those cases to come down.
One of the things that you said a moment ago, I think perhaps we should underline for people who are listening to the podcast, and that is that because we have majority rule in the United States, many Americans believe that the majority view should be the view that holds forth in all cases. And in effect, the Constitution says something different than that. The Constitution says there will be majority rule for the purposes of electing a president or a governor or a mayor or a legislature, but there will be protection of minority rights, minority views, even individuals, correct?
That is correct. And in particular, the government, there can be no establishment of an official religion, whether done overtly or whether done in particular respects. You can't have a policy that is specially designed to favor one religion over another.
Our guest has been Sasha Sandberg Champion, who is with Relman, Dane & Colfax in Washington. Sir, thank you very much for taking some time to talk with us. I appreciate it a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Religion and the Constitution is meant to offer a brief history of freedom of religion in the United States. It's intended to help you interpret what freedom of religion means in everyday life. These conversations with the legal experts and the narration will not answer every question about what the courts have said about religious freedom. They do attempt to give you a basic understanding of the law. Nothing here should be taken as legal advice. If you have a problem concerning religious freedom, you should contact qualified legal assistance. Thanks to Josh LaBella for helping with the research and street interviews. And thanks to Tedra Schneider for creating the theme music. And thank you for listening. I'm Jerry Dunkley.